Those who have died have never known the dead. The dead are not under the earth. They are in the rustling trees. They are in the groaning woods. They are in the crying grass. They are in the moaning rocks. The dead are not under the earth.
Once again, Sweet Honey in the Rock, this time with Breaths. This is the birthday of Bernice Johnson Reagan, who founded Sweet Honey in the Rock, and the Mississippi Freedom Singers that became the SNCC Singers. This day, we're going to continue our conversation. We're going to be doing this conversation a lot in the coming year. Transportation is something that has grabbed a lot of our listeners. They've written to us. They have let us know that this is something they want us to wrestle with and talk about beyond the red line, but also including the red line, but way beyond the red line, what the future of transportation brings to this community. And the frustrations we all have, whether we are stuck on the JFX, the JFX, or whether we are stuck in traffic in downtown Baltimore or around the Beltway, or frustrated by the buses we catch because the next one doesn't hook up with the one that we just got off of to try to catch another one, that subways and trains don't meet each other with the bus. All those frustrations, does it have to be that way? Cyclists getting hit, run over by cars, does it have to be that way? Can it be better? How do we make it better? So we have this conversation today once again. We are joined here in studio with Jimmy Rouse, who, along with Robin Budish, created Transit Choices, which is a group working towards a unified vision of transit in Baltimore, trying to bring a huge, diverse group of Baltimore City together to talk about this, diverse in many ways, including people who support the Red Line and people who have deep questions about the Red Line in dialogue about what the future could be. So Jimmy joins us once again. It's always good to have him in the studio.
Thank you.
Dr. John Bullock is in the studio, professor of political science at Towson University, who was a transportation planner in Washington, D.C. in his previous life. Mel Freeman joins us by phone. Executive Director of the Citizens Planning and Housing Association. Mel, good to have you with us as well.
Hi, Mark.
Hope your back is feeling better.
We're getting there.
Good. I know how that feels. Art Cohen is with us, convener of Be More Mobile and partner in the Right Rail Coalition. Good to have you in the studio, Art.
Thank you.
And Gerald Neely in the studio, a transportation planner from Baltimore City Department of Planning from 1977 to 96, and has written Baltimore Inner Space, which was named Best Urban Planning Blog of 2008 by the Baltimore City Paper. And, Jerry, good to have you with us as well.
Thank you very much.
410-319-8888. We want you to join us here. Are you a bus rider? Do you take the subway? Do you take the light rail? Or as we call it, the snail, the light snail that takes us from one place to the next. Are you a bike rider? Does your world revolve around taking the bus to get to work? 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I've got one email already that we'll read in a little bit. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. My phone is with me here to see what you have to say. Or log onto our Facebook pages. I already see one comment on there from Tyrone that we will read as well. The Mark Steiner Show page and Mark Steiner page. 410-319-8888, the future of transportation. Jimmy Ross, let me start with you. welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And I know that the whole controversy will come to the fore here about what's going to happen with the new proposed red line. But it's beyond the red line, even though the red line's a piece of this. And I think we can take a step back, just for our listeners, and talk just a minute about the transit choices, because this is something you have been, I've known you for a long time. Your first, and I say obsession, I mean it in a positive sense, not a negative sense. We're obsessed with the idea of building a system of streetcars going up and down Charles Street to kind of change the nature of transportation, move things around. But it's gone beyond that for you in terms of what you're thinking about we have to wrestle with.
So we were originally I was looking at building a streetcar up Charles Street, but as we began talking to people across the city, it became very clear to us that Baltimore needs more than just a streetcar, that what it was lacking was any sort of unified vision for how we could bring real mass transit into the city. So we formed a group called Transit Choices and tried to bring in all the different voices talking about transportation in the city into one group to envision what would be ideal for Baltimore and doable to create a real viable system an economically efficient system of mass transit in the city, but looking at all the different options, looking at what's in place now with the metro and light rail, bringing in streetcars, looking at bikes and bike sharing, looking at making the water taxi into a commuter system so it doesn't just serve tourists, so people can get from Canton and Inner Harbor East across to Tide Point, where Under Armour is about to hire 1,500 more people. Looking at car sharing programs like Zipcar that's in the city now. How do you combine all these things into one vision so that people can really live in Baltimore without a car, get to jobs, so the jobs are created in Baltimore because the transportation system's so effective, rather than created out in the suburbs? So this is our attempt, and we have work groups now working around each of those different modes of transportation, asking the question, what would be ideal in each mode, and then coming together to see if we can unify it into a vision for the city. And that's what we're doing now. Let me just say one other thing. Mm-hmm. We don't want to just create a plan. We want to see that the plan's implemented. So we're working on what we're calling a quick hits list. Low cost, high visibility, high impact things that can be done in the year 2014 to improve Baltimore's transportation system. And there are a lot of things that can be done along that line. For instance, every light rail stop should have Zipcar and bike share at the stop so that it extends the reach of the systems that we have in place. Same with the metro. If you get off the metro, you ought to have an option of taking Zipcar or bike share so you can go further than just the rail line without a car. That's a very simple thing. Making the water taxi into a commuter system, that's a simple project that could be done within the year 2014. Bringing bike share to the city would be a huge change for this city. And
that's, as D.C. has.
That'll be a D.C. and New York just added.
Right.
And so there's no map right now. We have light rail, metro, circulator, water taxi, but for a tourist coming into the city, there's no map or signage which shows how those systems interconnect.
Let alone for a citizen who has to go to work or go somewhere.
Right. I mean, there's nothing. There's no signage. There's no mapping that shows what we have presently. So that's another thing that we could do in the short term.
So I'm going to come, before we finish the conversation over the next hour and 40 minutes or so, hour and a half or so, I'm going to come back to some of the things you mentioned about how you get to 2014. We're going to take a very brief break. We have callers, Allie, Mike, and Bruce in that order. We have an email comment here. We have an email and also a Facebook comment. But when we come back, I want to just very quickly explore why it's been so difficult to get to where we are today, just to get a sense of our history for just a moment. I don't want to belabor it. I want to understand it. Because we look at Washington, D.C., you know, from the destruction of our trolley system to the refusal to build a subway system in Baltimore that put us way behind the eight ball. Just talk about that for a minute so we get a sense of that. And then how we rectify that, since we know we're not going to have a subway system sometime in the next 10 years, if ever. So let's deal with that. We're going to come right back to transportation. And Allie, Mike, Bruce, we're going to come to you in that order. And we'll be right back, and also read our emails and our Facebook pages. Stay with us.
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
More than just a paycheck, sweet honey in the rock. This is the birthday of Bernice Johnson Reagan. She turns 42. Happy birthday to one of the great cultural leaders of our nation. I'll remind you, talking about more than a paycheck, WEA's fall membership drive begins October the 12th. That's a week from Monday. So from October 12th through the 20th, we need pledge room volunteers for this program and other programs. please volunteer to show your support for your public radio station, WEAA, at 443-885-2075. That's 443-885-2075. Or go to WEAA.org and volunteer online. Fill out there. You can also pledge. It's never too late or early to make your pledge to public radio. So do that. We are here talking about the future of transportation in our community. We are joined by Jimmy Rouse, who helped found Transit Choices, Dr. John Bullock, political science professor at Towson University, former transportation planner in Washington, D.C., Mel Freeman, executive director of CPHA, Citizens Planning and Housing Association, Art Cohen, convener of Be More Mobile, and partner in the Right Rail Coalition, pardon me, Gerald Neely, who is a transportation planner here in the city from 77 to 96, and wrote the Baltimore Inner Space, an award-winning transportation blog, 410-319-8888. So, gentlemen, since it's all men on this panel today, we'll rectify that next panel. We'll let's kind of talk quickly about why we think we are in the situation we're in, where we can just go down the road 45 miles to a city that seems to be so far ahead of us in thinking about transportation. Mm-hmm. And, John, you were a D.C. planner.
Right, right. You know, all cities in America have really suffered from some bad policy decisions. We can go back to the 40s and 50s and 60s and see how groups like the City Transit Lines, which is really a front company for Standard Oil, Firestone, and GM, really bought up all these transit lines, limited services, and then really just made us really auto-dependent, not only automobiles in terms of personal vehicles, but also the bus system. Now, later on, we saw how other cities like Washington, D.C. invested in rail. Unfortunately, you know, the United States, unlike Western Europe and Japan, we didn't invest in rail and mass transit like they did. And so some of our cities came to the game a little bit late. Obviously, New York and Philadelphia and Chicago had longer running lines. But in terms of D.C., the 1970s was a really critical period in terms of investing in transportation. There was an opportunity to match to get federal funding and also provide some local funding to actually get Metro off the ground. Also, you had the collaboration between not only the district but also Maryland and Virginia. Now, that's been a great economic boon for Washington, D.C. You can pretty much get anywhere in the city via the Metro. I think Jimmy Rouse is correct in terms of how you partner rail with some of these other things like bike sharing and car sharing. When I was in D.C. working for the Department of Transportation, we also had serious attention toward having a bicycle and pedestrian coordinator. So really trying to get bike lanes in the city, trying to do all those things that would make it a comprehensive system. As far as Baltimore, we didn't make that same investment. When there was an opportunity to have a comprehensive system like D.C., we didn't make that investment. And because of that, anything that we do now is going to be a little bit late, obviously, but it's also going to be quite expensive. We know that we really have fragments of a system. So we've talked about a metro that really only goes north and south, doesn't really connect. We've talked about having a light rail system, the potential red line, a circulator. But what we don't have is connectivity. And so to have a unified vision, to have something comprehensive, we have to find the pieces to bring them together. Interestingly enough, I know some of my colleagues will talk about streetcars, and what's interesting is we used to have streetcars, and hopefully we can go back to having a comprehensive system that have streetcars, light rail, and the like.
So let me ask you, let me go to Art Cohen, but also not to be repetitious in terms of what we just heard. Bring us something new so we can just keep this rolling, all right?
Well, I want to I think part of the problem here in Baltimore with where we are in transportation is we've never really become a regional system. This is taking it a step beyond what Jimmy was saying about developing a vision for future a city transportation. What John just said about D.C. is an example of a regional system. I mean, you've got two states and the District of Columbia, but somehow they manage to work together, and they're all connected. They're not connected just by for commuters. They're connected for people who want to enjoy the whole region. We need the same thing here, and we haven't had it. I will just say one quick thing about governance. If you look around the country, there are only four states in the country, Maryland's one of them, that plans its local transportation from the state level. The others are New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Delaware. There is currently as a result of the legislature this past spring, a commission that is studying the development of a regional authority here in Baltimore. That might be a key to long-range future planning for the region that could be beneficial to us. We'll see what comes out of that commission. They don't have very long to do their work, but they should be reporting fairly soon. But you look at a place like Portland, Oregon, it has an excellent integrated transportation system, and they have a regional authority that had a lot to do with planning and running that.
And Mel Freeman, go ahead. Mel, you there?
Yes. One of the bit of promise that we have today is that, yeah, Transit Choices has come together, brought different folks with different visions to try and connect everything. We have MTA coming out with their BNIP program, which has a little bit of promise. It took us forever to get another Secretary of Transportation for the state. That didn't exactly make things go any smoother, and I think we're on our third MTA administrator. So I mean,
more than that.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things that are just, you know, it seems to just take so long, and it shouldn't be for something that's so important to this region.
Okay. Baltimore does have a great world-class transit facility, the 16-mile Baltimore Metro. Back in the 1970s, when the Metro was being built, we were neck and neck with D.C., actually. We didn't fall behind until after the Metro was built. And in order to get back on track, basically what we need to do is use the Metro to the maximum that we possibly can to make it so that it's truly the backbone of the regional system, and then to fill in, as Jimmy said, with all of these more localized facilities in order to complement the Metro. The things at the stations like bike share, et cetera, but even more important, reconfiguring the bus system and the more subordinate rail systems such as streetcars in order to complement the Metro. And the big problem with the Red Line is that it does not do that. The Red Line was designed in an extremely narrow corridor. It has a two-block walk underground in order to get to the Metro. And it would cost so much money for how much smaller, slower, and less capacity it has than the Metro.
Let me open the phones here. 410-319-8888. Let you come right back in here, John. Allie, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my
Welcome.
Call. I wanted to say that when you look at the map of the transit in Baltimore, it covers, you know, the lines cover, you know, a good portion of the city, and they'd be great if the buses ever, you know, came. If
Absolutely.
They came on time and if they came more frequently. So the first thing, seems to me you were talking about before, what are the easy fixes, you know, right now that you could do right now? Hire more bus drivers and put more buses on the road.
What we need to do is...
Let her finish what you're saying. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so they don't come free. I mean, even if they came on time, which would be a big improvement, they don't come frequently. The scheduled time isn't frequently enough. So a road like Charles Street, you should have a bus coming up and down Charles every 3 minutes. I mean, some line should be going up and down Charles every 3 minutes. The 3, the 11, the 61, you know, they all hit Charles around the train station. If you're coming off the train from D.C., which I don't do anymore because I'm furloughed, but, you know, you shouldn't have to wait 40 minutes for some line. I mean, I can take any of those.
Okay. So I think that, Ali, I have some very strong points here, and I think that, I'll add to the mix in a moment, but why is it so hard to get the buses running coordinated on time? What is the difficulty?
you know, I'm not exactly sure what the difficulty is, but I think the caller is right in terms of having a regular service, especially along these major thoroughfares. I mean, we know that they're high volume, and we would need to have some adequate service there. So I think it's more of a planning and timing issue. In terms of talking about our metro system, unfortunately, I couldn't call that a world class system. I think part of the reason is that it only goes north and south,
16 miles.
One direction, north and south. And I think what we're lacking is an east-west connection. And I think that's what the red line is supposed to do, is to give that connection east and west. Then you can overlay some of the other things we've talked about. Unfortunately, having a metro line that is very limited hasn't been very effective. But once you can be able to have an east-west connection and then also partner that with other steps, that'd be important. So I look at the red line as only a first step toward a more comprehensive transportation system.
So, but the question I think Ali was trying to raise is why it's so difficult for a city to plan a bus system, just that system alone.
Well, part of the problem is the MTA is a state agency and the buses run in the city.
So what does that mean, Jimmy?
Well, what that translates to is the people that use the buses, you can lobby your city councilman all you want it, but they have no effect on MTA. MTA is a state agency. So you're not being the planning and the execution of the bus system is not accountable to the citizens of Baltimore.
That's why I said that point about regional. Having a regional authority would be much more accountable than a
to
state.
Actually manage something like the MTA. Yeah. And I also heard from an MTA driver, just as an aside, and I don't know if this is true or not, but what the MTA driver said to me, he said one of the reasons that buses don't come all the time on time is because if I call in sick, no one replaces me.
There's no
they take the bus.
I've heard that too.
They take the bus out of circulation. They don't bring somebody in to take my place.
The biggest specific problem.
Insane, it seems to me, when you're running a system.
The specific problem is redundancy. Redundancy both from a physical standpoint, operational standpoint with the buses, and also with the jurisdictions responsible for running the buses. The caller talked about the various lines that serve Penn Station. She could have also mentioned the Charm City Circulator. Instead of fixing the redundancy problem by coordinating all the various bus routes that serve Penn Station, the city put a wrench in it by adding another layer of redundancy in the Charm City's circulator. And now they're getting more money from the state in order to compete with the state MTA with the Charm City circulator. So instead, you need coordination. You have the same problem with the colleges. The colleges are now basically in the bus business.
They have their own transportation
system.
Right,
because they don't feel they can rely on the MTA. Mm-hmm. So you end up with a snowballing effect that once people can't rely on the MTA, they create even more redundancy and make the problem even worse. So instead, we need coordination, and we need economies of scale. When you split the bus system into all of these little pieces, you don't get the economies of scale that you can get when you run everything together.
So let me just jump in. On Charles Street right now, I counted 8 different bus lines, 3 from the MTA, the circulator, Johns Hopkins runs a bus, MICA runs a bus, University of Maryland runs a bus, University of Baltimore runs a bus. What you could run one streetcar up Charles Street and eliminate all those buses.
Absolutely.
You know, if you in a planned system. You know, what everybody's out for themselves is what's happening.
And you're going to take some traffic off the street, bus traffic off the street,
right,
if you do that. Yep.
Well, before we go to the next caller, let me just this with this email. It might fit into some of it and on some level, because there's a lot of layers here, mm-hmm, in terms of what the MTA does and doesn't do as a transit planning system for Baltimore and the region. The fact that now we have this anarchic system in many ways, of too many private systems versus a system that's, mm-hmm, coordinated publicly. But Betty just wrote in, and then we'll go to our next caller up. We'll go to Ed, our next caller, Mount Vernon. Betty just sent in, I would love to hear your panelists address the question of how race has played a role historically in the kind of transportation we now have and what the challenges are now regarding race and the region moving forward. And I think it's a good question. I mean, whether we're talking about the fact that the vast majority of people who use public transit in Baltimore at the moment are working class African Americans going to and from work and school. Whether we are talking about how we kind of plan what goes where, how does that factor into these little private bus lines for college students that are being built? When we talk about the water taxi system, will it go over to Cherry Hill to pick up people to bring them into work into the city? Or will it stop at in South Baltimore? You know, so I think there are a lot of these questions that are raising this. So what are our thoughts? Mel, we haven't heard from you, man. Why don't you start?
Well, you know, I'm going to start with my favorite place, Ruxton.
I got in a lot of trouble for taking on Ruxton. I don't mind, though. I'll keep doing it.
Ruxton is such a small tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, but it's emblematic. Go ahead,
Mel.
It's
just an example of how one group of folks can say, I don't want it, and another group of folks are left with dregs, what's left. If there was a higher number of non-white that really had access to better transit, things would be different.
Okay, the real problem is that the Metro isn't getting its due because it serves predominantly African-American people.
Let me focus on the issue that was raised by this listener. Anybody want to jump in?
Right. Well, you know, we know that race tends to play a factor in a lot of things that happen, not only in our city but our country as well. But we also know that race intersects with class. And so we look at where there is investments, whether it be in housing or transportation, whether it be in the Metro or other avenues in terms of transportation. We know there's a lack of investment. But what also happens is that because of some of the racial fracturing, there's a social distance that happens where if you look at the bus ridership, we can see that it's overwhelmingly African American, even though the city is also predominantly African American. But we know it's overwhelmingly African American and overwhelmingly a relatively lower income. And so we see that some people avoid mass transit, will stick to their own private vehicles, and so there isn't that that overall buy-in because of these race and class issues. I think Mel also raised a point around Ruxton. We do also have these issues of NIMBYism, right? Not in my backyard. And so if we believe that these types of projects will bring undesirables, whether they be based upon class or race, there tends to be opposition to whatever plan is presented.
Well, either you're going to have a public transportation system or you're not. If you're going to have a public transportation system, it's for everybody. And I heard David Simon the other day on a symposium say that we are paralyzed in this country, in our cities, by a climate of fear. And I think it seems like a simple kind of blanket kind of thing to say, but I think we're going to have to confront this in dealing with this issue of, do we want to have a public transit system or not? If we do, we're going to have to take this on. It was taken on in New York at a time when the subways were dangerous to ride, and they're no longer in that kind of situation. So I think we have to get beyond the fear question, and if we're sincere about having a public transportation system, part of what that means is that people mingle. They get on a vehicle. They start talking with strangers. It's part of what living in a city is about.
What we need is quality, and if we have quality, then everybody of every race will gravitate to it. If we don't have quality, which is the current situation, then the mass transit system will be a second-class transportation that won't be used by anybody who has a choice, and that's blacks and whites.
Well,
if people have a choice, they don't use it.
Mel?
We have the problem of, if we build it, they will come. We have a system that every chance that we take, someone chooses a different alternative, whether it's their own car or the colleges have chosen to put their own buses on the routes. And all these things are counter to how well this system can run. The more people that we get on the buses and trains, it's going to raise that very, very, little more amount in the fare boxes, which we know is one of our biggest issues in the region. But when everybody starts creating a new, for instance, every single college that has a bus system is adding to the factor as to how the students choose other cities once they graduate. In other words, if you're using the buses, you're going to learn the city, you're going to know what you like in the city. If you're using their particular shuttered routes where you never see anything but the same stops, the same people, just like Art just said, we need to get a system that we can mix the colleges So they're seeing different parts of the city. They're understanding how this city works. They learn to love the city, and they want to stay here and add to the population.
Jim, you want to jump in before we move on?
The Collegetown does a survey of outgoing college seniors in Baltimore, and for the last several years, 80% of outgoing college seniors have said the number one problem with Baltimore is its transportation system.
So, are we taking a break now? No. I heard music, that's why.
Jerry,
it's somebody's cell phone.
Sorry. Excuse me.
That's all right, all right. So let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Ed, you're on the air from Mount Vernon.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I just want to say that the Transit Riders Action Council has not been invited to participate in whatever Mr. Rouse is doing, and I'm the co-chair of both the MTA Citizens Advisory Committee and the MTA Citizens Advisory Committee on Accessible Transportation, and neither of these organizations have heard of it either, nor has the Transit Riders Action Coalition. A big part of the problem that we've had over the years is that transit riders are always brought into this planning process at the very end and then asked to ratify it. That was a huge problem on the Red Line, and it continues to be one. The Transit Riders Action Council has come up with a complete transit plan. They did it years ago. It has been taken offline, but I'll try and see that it gets put back online in a few days on the Transit Riders Action Council website, which is getontrack.com. It is, I'm sorry, .org, getontrack.org. There is no K in track, T-R-A-C. So in a few days, I hope that will be up and people will be able to view such a system. The key, however, to doing anything in Baltimore is to stop deferring what has been delayed for 60 years. We have to do something to put a high-speed Amtrak tunnel under Fayette Street, and the biggest reason is because the Baltimore and Potomac Tunnel is going to fall down. The second biggest reason is it is a national priority to build something that is high-speed, and the Great Circle Tunnel would be a redundancy if we have to build the high-speed tunnel. So it is important that we do that. We also have to build the freight tunnel from Marley Neck to Sparrows Point. Now, what does this have to do with transit? It has everything to do with transit, because the most difficult projects to build are the heaviest, and these are the heaviest that there will be. And they have the least flexibility. When we figure out where they have to go, they open up so much right-of-way that we will be able to build whatever we need, and we will be able to make it connect. But if we try and do things out of order, and if we try and do smaller systems that involve a lot of investment and infrastructure,
like first, the Red Line,
we'll get everything wrong. The Red Line is now down to 18.8 miles per hour with no crossover track in the center. If a train breaks down in the middle of the tunnel, they're going to send two-thirds of the trains back before they enter the tunnel. That's their plan.
All right. And I mean, clearly, we'll have to engage you more here in all this. Hold on a second. My producer is going to pick up the phone. But so what about what Ed was saying? Well, and from his saying they should be part of this conversation in a broader sense to his critique and plan.
You know, I think it's important to have, you know, all voices at the table, but we also have to think about the feasibility and how we implement some of these ideas. And so one of the criticisms some have in terms of the Red Line is in terms of cost. Well, if we're talking about all that heavy rail, that's going to be even more costly than the Red Line. One of the reasons why the Red Line is proposed is that it is mostly light rail, and of course, yes, it is not, you know, high-speed rail. I think one of the things in terms of high-speed rail that will be argued for, and some people have talked about this, is more so between Washington and Baltimore. That's really where the need for high-speed rail is. In terms of the tunneling, that's going to be much more expensive. We even know that just in terms of the tunnel in terms of the Red Line is going to be somewhat costly. But it is important to have all these folks at the table. We just have to remember that we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Right now, in terms of the Red Line, it is a good system. It may not be great. It may not be perfect. But at least it's a starting point, and we have to really be cognizant of what's feasible in terms of the money that's available, and then how can we implement it. I believe it's really going to be these incremental steps, but it's important to have all people at the table, especially transit riders as well.
A huge problem with the Red Line is the fact that it does not anymore fit into any kind of long-range plan. Ted, his brother Jimmy. Was just telling me before the show about how the state has no more plans after the red line is done. And that is a shocking thing to admit.
Well, I'm not shocked about that at all. But I also know that
I knew it was true. They admitted it. That's the thing that's amazing.
Let me just throw something out that might be an anathema to many people who oppose the red line. and I am just a journalistic agnostic on this on some levels. But if in fact the red line is going given, it's going to happen. I think if I was a betting man, and I'm not. And I was running a casino, I'd bet the red line was going to get built because that's the power of government and the power of the money they have and the investments they made, whether we agree with it or not, over the last bunch of years. I have a feeling that Mr. Smith and the gang are going to see it through. So just for argument's sake, if that in fact is the case, then what does that mean for the future transportation in the city?
Well, one thing is, let me just make one amendment to what you're saying. It's not too late to do the red line right. In other words, there's some aspects of the red line that are on paper now that could be changed and could be much more effective and more cost effective and tie in with the rest of our future transportation system. So I'm not against the red line, but I want to make sure they do it right.
Well, we need damage control is what we need.
Jimmy, do you want to comment on that?
I
mean, if that, let's just say it is a fait accompli, let's just for argument's sake say
well,
that's going to happen.
The view we're taking in Transit Choices is basically I agree that the city's for the red line, the state's for the red line. You still have to get the federal funding to make it work. And some people question whether the state, that's $900 million of federal funding, and some people question whether the state has the $1.7 billion that they say that they're going to commit to the red line. But assuming
which
that,
in their capital budget they don't.
Assuming that the red line gets built, let's make it the best possible system and connect it as best we can. And if it doesn't get built, let's have alternatives. Right. You know,
the number
so,
one.
So either way, you know, it either gets built or it doesn't get built. But we go on planning for a system that works.
Let's just take for granted that the red line is built. I think it's a great jumping off point for some of the other things we've talked about around this table. You know, you get the buy-in from communities, and you also connect them. In terms of a long-range plan, I think it's also great in terms of development. So again, I'm in West Baltimore at West Baltimore MARC station. Again, it's a potential in terms of being a transportation hub. It connects the MARC train to the red line. This could be great in terms of economic and economic development in that part of the city, connecting with people from D.C. who might be looking for housing opportunities in Baltimore. So it's good for our economy. I believe that we should also look at that as an opportunity to say, okay, we have these red line stations. Can we have bike share there? Can we have car sharing programs there? So I look at that as really the beginning of something else moving forward to the future.
We have to take a break. I'm going to come right back from this break. We're going to continue this conversation. I apologize to listeners who didn't get through yet and have left us because waiting to get online. Mike, you are the next caller up. You've been holding for a half an hour. We'll get to you when we come back. And some of you who didn't get on right away is because I know the names and we were trying to get people who have not called before, called in a few days and getting fresh voices on the line. But join us here at 410-319-8888 as we continue our conversation about the future of transportation in our community. We're going to go out here once again with Sweet Honey and the Rock, Study War No More. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my head was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back to our Transportation Roundtable. On the way there, I want to remind you that support for WEAA is provided by Monroe Shocks and Struts. Information available at monroe.com. And you're listening here to the Mark Steiner Show on WEAFM. And support for the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org, click on their banner, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. We are here with Jimmy Rouse, a founder of Transit Choices, a group working towards a unified vision of transit in Baltimore, Dr. John Bullock, a former Washington, D.C. transit planner, professor of political science at Towson University, Amel Freeman, executive director of Citizens Planning and Housing Association, Art Cohen, a convener of Be More Mobile and partner in the Right Rail Coalition, Gerald Neely, who was a transportation planner here in Baltimore City from 1977 to 1996, and since 2005 has written the Baltimore Inner Space, which is named the best urban blog of 2008 by Baltimore City Paper. The number here is 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages or tweet us at Mark Steiner. And let's go to the phones, 410-319-8888. And, Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, Mark. I have the good fortune of not having to use the transportation system, the public one, since the 60s. But in that time, I was taking the bus after getting out from Town Medical Academy at 6 o'clock in the evening, the number 5, and then having to transfer to the 21 on McCullough and Dolphin Street. Needless to say, I was not only accosted, but shaken down on more than one occasion and even robbed of my watch. That's mild compared to what goes on these days and inside the buses. And my question to the panel is policy. What is the policy going to be for bus drivers who see something like a robbery occurring on their buses and have to do something? Will they be asked to intervene or not? How can the bus riders be protected from being robbed on the buses, given a system that takes them to even the most rural of areas?
Look, granted, you know, safety is a real concern. You know, we know there have been instances, whether we're talking about on buses or outside. I mean, I think it's calmed down a little bit since the past few years, but I think it's important. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily advocate for the bus drivers to, you know, to play a huge role, but I think it's important to have transit police be beefed up, especially around stations. I think there's also something that we can do in terms of lighting, in terms of making these areas safer. But yes, I mean, public safety is a concern, and if we can really tackle that issue, I think more people would be encouraged to ride transit. But I know that some of the fears, in a sense, are overblown. Not to say that there aren't issues, but then once the story sort of snowballs, and it's like, oh, people are being attacked every day. That's not exactly the truth. But at the same time, we do know that safety is a concern. We have to be cognizant of that.
Yeah, I think that there's always going to be issues of crime no matter where you are, and I think that I think in some ways it is overblown in terms of the kind of crime that today. We see, you know, photos of somebody getting beaten up in a street corner or things happening, and then it becomes the watchword of the day that this is happening every day. It's, you know, and I don't think
the better system that we create, transit system, the more people will ride it, and safety comes with more riders. Mm-hmm. So right. If we plan a good system,
a unified system,
we are addressing the safety issue.
Mel, do you want to jump in on this at all before we move to the next subject?
No, the next one's fine.
So let me talk about something here. Folks, I really want you to come back in here, 410-319-8888, and join us here at 410-319-8888. I'm going to bring an email up about bicycle riding in the city that was sent to us. But let me talk about 2014 for a moment. You raised that. I think that, Jimmy Rouse, I'd be really anxious to hear about what you think can actually happen that would make a difference by 2014.
Well, we met with Jim Smith, head of Maryland Department of Transportation, and with William Johnson, who's the new head of the City Department of Transportation, and let them know that we were preparing this list of things. One of my greatest concerns with the Red Line is it's $2.6 billion. Will there be any money left over? There's 1.7 million coming from state and local. Will there be any money left over for any other transportation projects? So part of our effort to plan for 2014, they're saying, yes, there will be money, but I'm not convinced.
Very valid concern.
And we want to bring in a series of low-hanging, low-cost fruit that will have high visibility and make a big impact on the system to test to see whether they're going to actually make money available for other transportation projects simultaneously with the red line. So
as an example, what do you think can happen? What are these low-hanging fruits?
Well, making the water taxi a commuter system.
And let me ask a question about that, though. So we talk about that. So who runs the system? Is it a public system? Does it become a private system?
It's a private system that's leased, and the lease expires next year. So it could be leased to somebody that, if the present operator's not willing to turn it into a commuter system, then it could be operated by some other entity.
And how would you control things like pricing on that?
That's a question that the Water Taxi Committee is looking at now. How you make a successful commuter system? Because one of the problems that the present operator has is how do I make it a commuter system without cannibalizing the fact that it costs $7 now to ride for tourists, basically. It's not a commuter system. So how does he create a commuter system on top of his tourist system without losing his tourist business?
So I'll let you come right in, but I'm curious. The way it runs now, because I don't know. I've taken the water taxi once or twice just to see what it was like. Who owns the water taxis at this moment? Does the city own them, or is the guy who runs the operation own it? Who owns the water taxis?
I believe it's the people that are running the system.
So,
and I'm not an expert on this.
Okay, all right. I'm just curious how that might work, but yeah.
Another low-hanging fruit is signage, right?
Right.
Signage and maps and things that would really enable people to get along, get around the system, navigate the system such as it is today.
Take the bus system, for instance. If you're standing at a bus stop now, you have no idea when the next bus is going to arrive. In a modern transportation system, at every stop, you would have a sign which would say where the next bus is, how long it will take to get to your location. So that's something that's doable.
Paris, France.
You can do it with apps, which is good for people who can afford smartphones, but better yet, you would do it at the stop so that if you're waiting at a stop, it says next bus is like 12 minutes away, 10 minutes away, you know, and so you have an idea of when that bus is going to arrive. That would make the system a lot more usable, user-friendly.
Mel, do you want to jump in on this?
The Charm City Circulator is a good example of all those points with great signage, next bus arrival. Another low-hanging fruit would be the traffic pattern. We talked about this, getting the traffic lights to allow the right-of-way for the mass transit vehicle as opposed to the car.
Signal prioritization.
Correct.
There is a system in place for the present north-south light rail, but it's not operating effectively, according to what I understand. And having talked to Henry Kay at the MTA, it could operate better. But the amount of time that saves on that line maximum is approximately 3 minutes as it goes from Mount Royal to down to Camden Yards.
So there are other callers coming in here, and I'm really curious. I think those kind of things that they can generate kind of a movement in the city. Let me read this email that came in from David Schott, who writes in, "Don't forget about including biking in better, safer bike lanes and areas to secure bikes. I realize it's not a total answer, but it should be included in the mix. A rule of thumb is that a bike can rival a car in a 5-mile urban stretch. 10 miles per hour on a bike is not too difficult to do. I imagine the ride from UMBC is approximately 7 miles, i.e. about 45 minutes. So your interns, we talked earlier in this program about taking a bus from UMBC that Stephanie did when she was an intern here to our station a couple of years back. So your intern could save 1.25 minutes if it took her 2 hours going one way, commute via bus. Remember, there are varieties of bikes to accommodate people's needs. Recumbent bikes for those with back problems, hand crank for people with leg disabilities, women's bikes for a lower uppercut frame for the elderly, trikes for folks who need more than two wheels, folding bikes for folks with minimum storage space, etc. The outlays of public expenditure to offer secure routes are a lot less than building a subway, light rail, etc. Now, what about bikes?
I'm so happy that that the bike conversation has come in here today, because it's something we really have to pay attention to. I know even in the city, there was an attempt a couple of years ago, I'm thinking about on Monroe Street, where there were actually bike lanes that were there's a bike lane that was actually created, but then it was taken out within a couple of weeks. And I know that there really wasn't buy-in from the council person in that area, and
or
I think
the
it's,
community.
But at the same time, I think it's part of an educational piece, right? I mean, we have to recognize in terms of sustainability. If we're talking about the future in the 21st century, we know that oil prices are rising. We know we have limited quantities of oil. So we have to start thinking about alternative forms of transportation. So biking is great also in terms of health. We really have to have when we talk about a comprehensive system, it has to include bicycling and making it safe. And so I know there are groups around the city who are really trying to, trying to include families, younger people, older people involved in biking, but we have to give them space, or again, we don't get that that benefit of having bicycling. Also, connecting that with the buses. We know that there are opportunities for people to put their bikes on the buses. Again, connecting forms of transportation. So we have to keep the bikes and the pedestrians as part of this conversation, most definitely.
It's very, very important, and we have groups working. We have brought all together the bike groups on Transit Choices, and they're working on a system of bike lanes for the city to make the city more rideable. That's definitely a goal. And we also have a group around pedestrian to see how we can make the pedestrian experience friendlier in the city. And so people feel free to walk more. And you can use those two things to help connect what we have now.
Yes. In fact, I've heard the head of the Vancouver transportation system characterize public transit as a walk interrupted. Basically, you're leaving from where you're leaving to a stop. You're getting on public transit, then you're getting off, and you're walking to where your destination is. So the idea of pedestrian, it's central to all of this, particularly in a dense urban area.
I mean, if you get that, and since I called Stephanie's name out, who took that transportation from UMBC to WEA, Morgan State University, several years back when she was interning here. She said, right, but I'd have to bike down Wilkins bike through the Inner Harbor at rush hour with cars that don't even think bikes should legally be on the road, and all my friends have been hit by cars who bike daily.
Mm-hmm. It is a huge problem. But in 5 years ago, the number of people riding their bikes to work in Baltimore, I think the number was around 250. 5 years later, now the number is close to 1,500.
You can see
it. So there's a huge increase in people who want to ride their bikes in the city, and that helps, in making people more aware that this is a transportation. So there's an education component to it.
Right.
And there's creating bike lanes that are safer.
And wider.
That's a component of it. Where you put those bike lanes, that's a component. We're looking at all those things to try to figure out what would be the best system that we could get.
And I've seen the increase. The increase is fueled, I think, on two levels here. And then we'll go right to the phones to Rose, you're the next caller up. I've seen this kind of fuel. It's really interesting to watch. A lot of young people, mostly white, who are riding bikes, college students, young professionals, riding their bikes back and forth. I've also seen more and more folks, working-class folks from the African-American working-class communities, on bicycles, riding to and from grocery stores, to and from work. Mm-hmm. So there's two sets of populations that are leaping on their bicycles because they're less expensive and get you places. And I think it really is a big piece of where the future should be. All the buses, you should be able to put your bike on the front of the back. We have a little bit of that now going on. But this is people should be able to take their bikes onto the mass transit systems, the rail
right.
systems. I mean,
the water taxi. I should be able to take a bike on the water taxi.
Exactly. All the rest.
Plus, you should have bike share at every station. So if you take the water taxi and need to ride a bike, you can get on bike share.
And as I said,
go to a European city, go to Amsterdam.
Oh, most definitely.
You know, I mean, bikes are a major form of transportation in a lot of European cities.
And go to Washington, D.C. If there are bike share stands all over Washington, people all over D.C. use these bike shares. And one person who shall remain unnamed, but a city official said to me, well, we could never do that in Baltimore because people would steal the bikes. Mm-hmm. I went, this is how what we think like in this town. We have to stop thinking like this.
Right. Right. Well, if you can do it in New York and you can do it in Washington, we can do it in Baltimore.
Of course. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Rose, in Baltimore City, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hi.
Rose.
I would agree that increasing use of bikes is very helpful. However, my comment was harking back to the bus system that, in addition to knowing when the buses arrived, it would be helpful if when the buses came, they weren't full and passed people by at the bus stop. So increasing the number of buses, especially around middle schools and high schools when they're letting out or when the kids need to get to school. There's been issues with kids, you know, taking 2.5 hours to get home from school, especially at the newly opened Baltimore Design School. The buses around there just haven't been frequent enough.
What right. we need
Which
is
a magnificent school, by the way. Just want to add.
There is one point should be made right now. It was mentioned in passing as an acronym, BNIP. There's a bus network improvement program which is being started right now by the MTA. They're going to be looking at the bus system critically throughout the whole metropolitan area for the next year. And they're looking for public input.
What's
and
it called again?
BNIP, the Baltimore the Bus Network Improvement Program, BNIP. And you can go up on the web and you can find it that way through the MTA. Right now they are holding hearings, inviting comments and that sort of thing from the public, and will be all year at different places. So this is an opportunity to weigh in on the bus system.
So how does that fit into, let's say, a thing like you just raised, BusNIP, BNIP? How does that fit into the reality of planning and change? I mean, we have hearings, but do you think that change, that input will be taken seriously?
Well, we have people that are going to be on the Transit Choices, putting people on the BNIP board that are very progressive in their ideas of what busing could be in the city. Clearly, we need a vast change in the busing system, not just minor tweaking. We should be using buses. I mean, Jerry referred to the hub at Mondawmin as being a very good example of where bus traffic is connected to Metro, and it becomes a very efficient system. We need to be planning that all over in connection with the Red Line, in connection with other Metro stops.
It won't work with the Red Line, unfortunately.
Why not?
Because the Red Line trains only carry 140 people. A Red Line train isn't much bigger than a couple of buses being strung together. It carries one-fifth of what a Metro train carries, and it doesn't offer the kind of economies of scale that you need in order to make it viable to have people transfer from buses to rail. Another problem with the Red Line is that geographically it just doesn't orient with the vast majority of the bus system in the city the way that Mondawmin does. Mondawmin is geographically very strategically oriented to northwest Baltimore, so it ties it together. What we need is the Metro to be extended just a little bit beyond Hopkins Hospital so that you can do the same thing in northeast Baltimore that the Metro does with Mondawmin in northwest Baltimore. And by having two mirror image hubs, one on each side of the city, the entire bus system can be restructured through this BNIP process in order to really have the bus system and the rail system work in concert together. And that's why having a 16-mile heavy rail line like the Metro really is a great asset to this city, even if we can't eventually get the 100 miles that D.C. has. And unfortunately, the Red Line just doesn't do anything to further that equation.
I'm not going to battle that. Again, I think I think we've argued that point to death. But I think what's interesting, getting back to what the caller said, is really thinking about peak and off-peak times. We know that there are certain times of the day where we have students that are getting out of school. People tend to use it more heavily. And so can we actually have more buses during those times, having more consistency and better scheduling, especially as it connects not only with schools but also with employment centers and also shopping centers as well?
Major urban areas can't rely on just buses. It just the equation doesn't work economically. Big cities rely on high capacity rail systems,
which cost a lot of money.
Exactly.
Running buses costs even more in the long run. Every year operating costs goes higher and higher and higher.
Unfortunately, we don't think long run. We always think short run when it comes
to
money.
Yeah, that's why I'm here.
Whether it's our prison system or our rail system, but it's an interesting point about a place like Mandoma being a we just don't think of it as a hub. Mm-hmm. That could really be a hub for transportation in this.
Mandoma works great,
and it's a place for bike share. It'd be an incredible place for bike share for people.
Right.
Take off from there through Druid Hill Park into downtown
and car share
and to Leakin Park and to everything else. It would be an amazing location that you could build up there. 410-319-8888. Is it Janie? Jane, you're on the air.
Yes.
Hi.
I ride a bike, okay? Been riding a bike for 30 years. I've been hit a couple times by buses, cars. People ignore the fact that cycles are on their way in, and they just ignore the fact that they're out there. Have you ever been riding a bike lane and a bus is behind schedule, and he blows his horn right when he gets right up behind you? Mm-hmm. Or have you ever been in a situation where you're in a bike lane and the bus driver pulls out into the traffic and goes through the red light, which you're sitting there?
The key to making bike planning work is better community planning. If we have livable communities, bikes will fit in very well.
But to your point, I think, James, that And I would say this with all due respect to some of the many people I know who drive buses and who are people, acquaintances and friends of mine who I like a lot, that a lot of bus drivers and other people in the transit system need some lessons in their own civility when it comes to civilians in this city and how to drive with cars and how to drive with bikes and how to treat people on the road. I think that's an important piece that has to go along with this
right.
as well.
Absolutely. I think, you look around the country and you see other places that are a little bit more progressive as it relates to this, and you'll see, signs about sharing the road. And we haven't really got to that idea that we can actually share the road. And so we see that we have to recognize the streets, our thoroughfares are not just about automobiles, about buses and cars, but they're also about pedestrians and they're also about bicyclists. So really, giving some, putting some teeth to this, putting some real attention to the issues of bicycles.
So very quickly, I want to say.
We're almost out of time. Very quickly.
Along those lines, there are a lot of streets that have become one-way streets that could be restored to two-way that would go a long way toward taking.
That's another conversation.
Bikes can work very well on one-way streets.
So I think that's the conversation we've had before. We need to have that again about one-way and two-way streets in this city. But I think my main pickup and explore is why DC can sit here and plan a trolley car system that's about to be built in DC. Mm-hmm. And Baltimore can't seem to get there. I'm really curious what the difference is between the way D.C. Metro plans transportation and the way we plan transportation.
Right. Well, part of it is really that D.C. already has a full-service comprehensive transit system. And so what they're doing in Anacostia is really just something in addition to something that's already there. Since we don't have a comprehensive system, we're really almost starting from scratch. So once you have something, and this is the argument that I'm making in terms of the Red Line and other improvements, is that once you have something that's at least a little bit more comprehensive, then you can put other layers on top of it. But you have to have a starting point in order to do some of those other things. Again, Anacostia has a great metro system, a metro station.
D.C. is building 19 miles of streetcar or 22 miles of streetcar and planning another 19. And we could be doing the same. And there's streetcars being designed now which are self-powered and hydrogen fuel, which are absolutely carbon neutral. Mm-hmm. So from a sustainability point of view, from a economic development and job creation point of view, we should be looking seriously at a streetcar network in the city.
So this is just the beginning of our conversation. This will all be online. All the connections we made will be online at steinershow.org. We're going to continue this at least monthly to kind of push the future of transportation in our communities. And I want to thank all of us, all of my guests for being here, everybody here who's been so deeply involved in creating the kind of transportation system we want. Jimmy Rouse, founder of Transit Choices, good to have you in the studio. Dr. John Bullock, always good to see you here as well.
Good to be here.
Mel Freeman by phone. Art Cohen, Ed, Gerald Neely here in the studio. Both, thank you both all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break and go out. You're going to hear a piece called When It's Sleepy Time Down South, which is written by Otis Renee, who was born in 1898, founder of Excelsior Records, who wrote some of the great songs of all time. This song he wrote, When It's Sleepy Time Down South, became a signature song for Louis Armstrong. We go out with that. When we come back, we're going to find out what's the latest in the city paper and then talk to Katarina Vandenhoevel, publisher of The Nation and others, about what's happening on Capitol Hill. Stay with us. We'll be right back.